BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday the 30th of September edition of Dialect Radio. Well, we take a trip up the M5 to Birmingham today, where the chairman of Birmingham Central Mosque explains how Muslims in the city are getting on really well with the local community. They are calling for an inquiry into the London bombings and exposing some of the extremist so-called Islamic groups as non-Muslims. We hear from the latest about Amnesty International. Matthew Heap has his muse on the news, and Malcolm Grieve, the actor, gives us another edition of Cider with Rosie. Back again after a week in the Fens, it's the What's On Guide and Song of the Week from our own Jeff Sparks. All that and more coming up, so let's go over to the surgeon, Dr. Nassim, chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque, interviewed by freelance journalist Tony Gosling.
Well, I classify myself as a social worker. Incidentally, I'm chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque. And it's one of my obligations under the company law, according to the Articles of Association, I have to look after the interests of the Muslim. And being a Muslim, I'm also obliged to look after the interests of the wider community, because that's part of the religious commitment. So it is in that context that I do whatever I can. Al-Muhajirun and Hizb ut-Tahrir, they are just two sides of the same coin. I think it may be just for strategical reason that they have split into two, but they have got the same ideology, same methodology. And I came into contact with them at the time of Bosnia, when Bosnia was attacked and there was conflict going on. And I had a meeting here in this hall, which was attended by citizens of this city, mostly non-Muslim, of all kind of persuasion. And what amazed me is that some young people barged into the hall and said, "You are doing this against Islam. You have got non-Muslims in the mosque, and that is forbidden." And I have never come across this opinion before in my life. And I was surprised that these people, who are supposed to be working for Islam, are presenting a picture of Islam, which is absolutely wrong. And it can only be presented if you want to put Muslim people away from Islam. From that experience, my perception was that this must be a group of people who intend to present a picture of Islam which is unacceptable to the Western mind. Now, on that premise, I invited them to, because I wanted to know more. That was my perception, but I could have been wrong. I invited them to come and have a discussion. They promised and they never turned up. It happened two or three times, and then I was invited when, what is the name of that gentleman who was the head of Hizb ut-Tahrir at that time, who is now in Beirut, Lebanon. I was once invited to a meeting where Umar Bakri was present. So it was a meeting arranged for me to talk to Umar Bakri because his juniors did not feel qualified to talk to me. I spoke to him. I had one sitting, and I pointed the error of his opinion. And then there was a second meeting was arranged. and he never turned up.
So what, isn't it really just a difference of ideology? Surely you're interpreting the Quran in one way and they're interpreting the Quran in a different way.
The thing is, there is no way they can interpret the Quran the way they are interpreting. That is a problem. Because I have not studied Quran because of an emotional reason. I was an agnostic in my formative years. I have studied because I became convinced that there is a God who has created this, who is the lawgiver. Then it was just a choice to make between Hinduism, Sikhism, Christianity and Islam. It was, to me, it was the same, different sides of the same coin. I have opted for Islam because I agreed with it more than anything else. So, having read Quran with that kind of approach, I could not understand how anybody could present this, because this was an emotional presentation of the Quran. There was no justification. If you are ignorant, then you can sell this story. If you're not ignorant, you couldn't sell it to anybody. And that's what these people were doing. Democracy is forbidden. Non-Muslims should not be allowed in. Now, they didn't know them. In Prophet's time, a delegation of Christians came to the mosque. 60 people, headed by an archbishop, they stayed for 1 week in the mosque. They said their prayers in the mosque. And I checked with the Roman Catholic bishop here as to how many prayers were they supposed to perform in a day at that time. And he said about three or five. So that means Muslims were saying their five-time prayer, Christians were saying their prayer at the same time, and as Protestantism was not there at that time, they must have imagery. So they might have been allowed to use their imagery in performing their prayer. So how could any Muslim say that they are forbidden? And there's a whole chapter in the Quran devoted to that incident when these people came and stayed in the Prophet's mosque. So that is why I say there's no way you can present another picture, because it is there in black and white.
So where do you think these people are coming from, Al-Majarun?
Then I further studied Muhammad Umar Bakri, and what is not well known, at one time he was appointed on the Race Relations Commission Board. And then this news I read myself in the Times, and then suddenly it was removed. There's no trace left of it.
Oh, from the internet?
I have tried, asked people to try to look in the internet when he was, but nobody had come with a finding. So I think this has just been erased. Then, further thinking, who would be interested in creating this picture of Muslim? Unless it is somebody who has already said the rules of the games have changed. So we can tell lies, we can do anything as long as it serves our political purpose. So I concluded as a deduction from that premise that they must have link with organizations or representatives of that political system which is interested in creating this impression amongst non-Muslims.
Thank you to Dr. Mohammed Nassim, chairman of the Birmingham Central Mosque. Pseudo-Muslim groups and why he believes these groups are not following the Quran and why they are playing into the hands of Western intelligence agencies. And on that note, it's time for The Seekers with We Shall Not Be Moved.
Well, I'm on my way to heaven, we shall not be moved. On our way to heaven, we shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water's side. We shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water.
Well, that was a blast from the 60s with The Seekers and We Shall Not Be Moved. It's now time for our Matthew Heap to give his muse on the news.
Right, John, what do you reckon the great star of Africa is?
I don't know, some kind of football legend who's recently joined Chelsea, I'm betting.
In 1905, a 3,106-carat uncut diamond was found. And after they'd actually cut this down to a normal size, so it could be actually called a diamond, it was 530 carats. And it's one of the largest diamonds that have ever been found in the world. And the reason I mention this is that another one's been discovered in South Africa recently, which weighs 478 carats, which is the 20th largest ever found in the world. Diamonds are kind of crazy things, really, because if you think about a pencil, you ask yourself, what is inside that pencil? It's not lead, obviously, because that was the old days.
Yeah.
It's carbon. And all a diamond is squashed carbon under a lot of heat and a lot of pressure over many, many years. But it's all it is carbon. And these things obviously fetch so much money. And this one that's just been discovered is obviously going to fetch many thousands of pounds. So just in case you're planning to buy that for your wife or girlfriend, you're going to need a significant pay rise. Well, maybe that's being a bit sexist, though, because that's assuming that it'll be the bloke's job to buy the diamond for his wife, and it might in fact be the other way around, or in fact the wife might buy it for herself. But there is a recent evidence now from a long-standing bit of research that ran from 1979 and is still running. And what they did, they took a very large cohort of men and women, and they asked the men and women what their salary was. And they asked them some basic questions about a woman's place in society, such as, is the woman's place at home? Is it bad for the woman to go off and work? What's the effect on the children? And they tried to link those kind of viewpoints on a woman's place in society with a person's salary. And as I said, this has been running since 1979, and they're still asking the same kind of bunch of women and men now to see whether, as they get older, their opinions change. And the conclusions of this study so far have been the following: that men with traditional views, which is women should stay at home, earn on average £4,722 more than men who are classed as modern thinkers who think that women are equal in society. There are women, of course, who also have traditional values, and there are women who have modern values, and they've worked out the women with modern values who think it should be the man's job to stay at home. They only earn £833 more on average than women who believe that their rightful place is at home. So it just goes to show, on the basis of this study, men with sexist views apparently earn more. It's an unlikely problem for our next pair, who recently met for a photo shoot, and that's the world's smallest man from Mongolia, called He Ping Ping, who is only 74 centimetres tall. And he's recently met a lady with the world's longest legs, for a female. Her legs are 132 centimetres long. She's from Russia, and her name is Svetlana Pengratona, I believe. Excuse my Russian. I guess that in many countries like Russia and Mongolia, men are men and women are women. But some countries have a long history of dressing their men in ways that others might feel are slightly effeminate. Scotland, in fact, where some of the country's leading kilt makers are meeting in Perth to determine exactly what is and what is not a Scottish kilt. And they're obviously feeling under a lot of threats that there's a lot of foreign imports in the world of kilts, and they need to protect the true kilt that's made in Scotland according to a very regimented set of standards. So you could say the Scottish men are traditionally in touch with their feminine side. On the contrary, some women might actually find that men with kilts are quite a turn-on, really, and it's an ultimate sign of masculinity. Well, some women go for Italian footballers, so it depends on your taste. I can't imagine Italian footballers going for skirts. There's recently been a bit of controversy with Italian footballers. Millions of pounds of European Union funds that were meant to help a poor region in Italy, it's been found they've actually been redirected towards the Italian national football team. And the justification for this is that by giving all this extra money to the Italian national football team, it would attract more tourists to this part of South Italy. This, it should be mentioned that this part of Italy is home to one of the most powerful and violent mafia organisations in the world. And the Italian EU minister, who has been lobbying to investigate why all this money is not going towards helping the poor region of Italy and instead going to the national football team, might well have to watch his back. Apparently a favourite way of disposing of people they don't like for this particular mafia organisation is to hang them upside down, which perhaps should be left to the US illusionist and magician David Blaine, who's just begun another endurance challenge. He's planning to hang upside down for almost 3 days. And this is despite doctors' concern that there'll be a negative effect on his internal organs and blood circulation. When questioned about it, he did admit that his head was beginning to feel like it was going to explode. This is compared to his previous stunts, which include spending 72 hours encased in ice, 7 days underwater, and 44 days without food in a glass box. All those things sound quite impressive, really. I think hanging upside down for 3 days sounds a bit boring, really. But he actually says this is his most difficult mission so far. So that's the Americans, and I guess they are very different to us in their cultures, and none more so, apparently, than the way we treat our teeth. Ricky Gervais apparently had to explain to a journalist that he wasn't wearing his teeth on purpose for comic purposes. This journalist had said, "Well done, Ricky, I really respect the fact you're wearing those comedy teeth." No, actually, they are my real teeth, he had to explain. And, of course, Americans have this idea that uniformity is the equivalent of looking good, whilst the British character is substantially more free-spirited and radical. So, yeah, all those dentists are earning a lot of money from American vanity. And what must doctors in general think of us when we come and see them? Well, most of us think of doctors in a very high regard, really. But there's a long, long history of doctors using slang or code to describe patients which they have a dislike for, which might change your opinion of some doctors. Although apparently because of increasing rates of litigation, this is happening far less often. I'm going to let you in on a few of their acronyms that you should watch out for when you're at the doctor's. Beware if you see any of this kind of being scribbled down on the doctor's notepad. NFN, normal for Norfolk. FLK, funny looking kid. TTFO, well, it could mean told to go away, but I'm sure we can all think of other less polite ways to unpack the acronym. LOBNH, lights on but nobody home. Pumpkin positive, if this gets written down, it means in the world of doctoring the implication that if a pen light was shone into the patient's mouth, they would encounter a brain so small that the whole head would light up. And it gets worse. DBI, Dirt Bag Index. This is referring to someone who they have to estimate the number of days since they last bathed, and the number of tattoos and missing teeth. And apparently this is an international language between doctors that wherever a doctor is working, they will understand each other with these acronyms. But it's not just towards patients, it's also towards colleagues as well. And rheumatology apparently is considered by some hard-pressed juniors as one of the less busy specialities, and this has been known as rumour holiday. Psychiatrists are known as the fraud squad, and there's a whole long list I won't go into now. Of course, technology can help us all keep out the reach of doctors, and this is particularly important for the elderly, who obviously will have more chance of needing to go and see the doctor. And a Japanese company has capitalised on this. They've designed an airbag to stop elderly people injuring themselves falling over. The device is strapped to the body and inflates in 0.1 seconds if it detects the person accelerating towards the ground. It's a bit unfair, really. You must look a bit silly with this kind of airbag strapped to you. What it is to be young again, they must feel. And to finish this week's Matt's Muses, we finish on a story I love, which is about a year 2 primary school girl called Lucinda, who didn't quite realise what she was taking on when she agreed to be fruit monitor. The class's favourite fruit, as it turns out, is bananas, and while she was handing out these packets of bananas to the class, she happened to see a spider jealously guarding its eggs inside one of the bunches. And she told the teacher, and the teacher obviously got the kids out of the room until they knew what the spider was, and the RSPCA were called to take the spider away. And once the headmaster had gone away and done some internet research, the conclusion was that this was one of the most venomous animals in the world. In fact, this particular spider from Brazil is responsible for causing more human deaths than any other venomous animal. Its name is slightly less impressive, though. It's called the Brazilian Wandering Spider, hardly a name to instill fear. And that brings to a close this week's Matt's Mused. Over to you, John.
Thank you very much, Mr. Heap. It's now time for Maggie Holland and A Place Called England.
I rode out on a bright May morning like a hero in a song, looking for a place called England, trying to find where I belong. Couldn't find the old flat meadow or the house that I once knew. No trace of the little river or the garden where I grew. I saw town and I saw country, motorway and sink estate. Rich man in his rolling acres, poor man still outside the gate. Retail park and Burger Kingdom, prairie field and factory farm, run by men who think that England's only a place to park their car. But as the train pulled from the station through the wastelands of despair, from the corner of my eye, a brightness filled the filthy air. Someone's blown a patch of sunflowers, though the soil is sooty black. Marigolds and a few tomatoes right beside the railway track. Down behind the terraced houses, in between the concrete towers, compost heaps and scarlet runners, secret gardens full of flowers. Meter grows the scent of roses right beneath the big jet's path. Bit of fortune for her garden, Eileen turns away and laughs. So rise up, George, and wake up, Arthur. Time to rouse out from your sleep. Deck the horse in the sea green ribbons, drag the old sword from the deep. Hold the line for Dave and Daniel as they tunnel through the clay, while the oak in all its glory soaks up sun for one more day. And come all you at home with freedom, whatever the land that gave you birth, there's room for you, both root and branch, as long as you love the English earth. Room for vole and room for orchid, room for all to grow and thrive. Just less room for the fat landowner on his ass in his four-wheel drive. England is not flag or empire, it is not money. It is not blood, it's limestone gorge and granite fell. It's Wealden clay and Severn mud. It's blackbird singing from the may tree, lark ascending through the scales, robin watching from your spade, and English earth beneath your nails. Not yet dead, a Mr. Harden sort of England. hanging in there by a thread. Here's two cheers for the crazy diggers. Now their hour shall come around. We can plant the seed they saved us, Commonwealth and common ground.
A place called England by Maggie Holland. Our Anthea Page went along to the local Amnesty International group and spoke to a lady who's part of a new international campaign against poverty and human rights and looking at the links between those two.
I'm at Amnesty International and I've met a lady who's got a very interesting and new project on the go. Can you tell us your name and a bit more about your project, please?
Well, my name is Wendy and I'm a member of the Bristol Amnesty group.
Yeah.
And Amnesty is starting shortly a campaign that's called Poverty and Human Rights. And what it's going to do is make the connections quite clearly between poverty and human rights abuses throughout the world.
Is this an international campaign?
It will be ultimately an international campaign. At the moment we're starting in the United Kingdom with some work, some campaigning work. And by next year it will be more of an international campaign, probably going on for a number of years.
And how do you think this campaign can actually help people get above the poverty trap?
I think what the campaign is designed to do is to make clear the relationship that there is between poverty and human rights abuses. So, for instance, the links that there are between people being forced from their homes, for instance, abroad in different countries, and the link that there is between that and their lack of resources.
Because you gave us some alarming figures tonight about the wealth in the world, how it's owned by corporate companies. Could you just give us...
Yes, there's an interesting statistic that says that 51 of the world's hundreds wealthiest bodies are actually corporations. They're not national states anymore, but actually transnational organisations, for instance. And so, the balance has shifted between the wealth being owned by nations towards being owned by multinational companies, for instance.
And how long do you think this situation has existed?
I don't know. I mean, it's a trend that is moving that way, is all I can say. It wouldn't have been the case 10 years ago, I'm sure.
That was Dialect Radio regular Anthea Page contributing there, interviewing a lady at the local Amnesty International. They meet up on the third Monday of every month at the Youth Hostel Association, which is opposite the Watershed and next to the Arnold Feeney. They meet up around 7:30 to 8, so if you turn up about that time, that'd be fine. It's also next door to the Architecture Centre, if that helps you to locate where it is.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now it's time for the actor Malcolm Grieve to read another instalment of Cider with Rosie, abridged especially for Dialect Radio.
Sided with Rosie by Corey Lee. Our house had once been a small country manor, and later a public beer house, but it decayed even further by the time we got to it, and was now three poor cottages in one. The house was shaped like a T, and we lived in the downstroke. The top stroke, which bore into the side of the bank like a rusty, expended shell, was divided separately among two old ladies, one's portion lying above the other's. Granny Trill and Granny Wallen were rival ancients and lived on each other's nerves, and their perpetual enmity was like mice in the walls and absorbed much of my early days. With their sickle-bent bodies, pale pink eyes and wild wisps of hedgerow hair, they looked to me like the very images of witches, and they were also much alike. In all their time as such close neighbours, they never exchanged a word. They communicated instead by means of boots and brooms, jumping on floors and knocking on ceilings. They referred to each other as "her down under" and "her up atop, the varmint," for each to the other was an airy nothing, a local habitation not fit to be named. Her down under, who lived on our level, was perhaps the smaller of the two, a tiny white shrew who came nibbling through her garden, who clawed squeaking with gossip at our kitchen window or sat sucking bread in the sun. Always mysterious and self-contained and feather-soft in her movements, she had two names which she changed at will according to the mood of her day. Granny Wallen was her best, and stemmed, we are told, from some distinguished alliance of the past. Behind this crisp and trotting body were certainly rumours of noble blood, but she never spoke of them herself. She was known to have raised a score of children, and she was known to be very poor. She lived on cabbage, bread, and potatoes, and she also made excellent wines. What seasons fermented in Granny Wallen's kitchen! What summers were brought to the boil with limp flower heads piled around the floor, holding fast to their clotted juices, the sharp, spiced honey of those cowslips first, then the coppery, reeking dandelion, the bitter poppy's whiff of powder, the cat's breath, death-green elder. And not only flower heads went into these brews. The old lady used parsnips too, potatoes, sloes, crab-apples, quinces, in fact anything she could lay her hands on. Granny Wallen made wine as though demented, out of anything at all, and no doubt, if given enough sugar and yeast, could have made a drink out of a box of old matches. "Hey there, missus, try this and then. It's the first of my last year's cowslip." Through the kitchen window she'd fill up our cups and watch us, head cocked, while we drank. The wine in the cups was still and golden, transparent as a pale spring morning. It smelled of ripe grass in some faraway field, and its taste was as delicate as air. Very soon we'd be wedged, tight crammed in the window, waving our cups for more, while Mother, bright-eyed, would be mumbling gaily, "Lord bless you, Granny, fancy cowsnips and parsley. You must give me the receipt, my dear." Granny Wallen would empty the jug in our cups, shake out the last drops on the flowers, then trot off tittering down the garden path, leaving us hugging ourselves in the window. Whatever the small indulgences with which Granny Wallen warmed up her old life, her neighbour Granny Trill had none of them. For her up atop was as frugal as a sparrow and as simple in her ways as a grub. She could sit in her chair for hours without moving, a veil of blackness over her eyes, a suspension like frost on her brittle limbs, with little to show that she lived at all save the gentle motion of her jaws. One of the first things I noticed about old Granny Trill was that she always seemed to be chewing, sliding her folded gums together in a day-long ruminative cud. She lived entirely on tea and biscuits, and on porridge sent up by the squire. Granny Trill had an original sense of time, which seemed to obey some vestigial pattern. She breakfasted, for instance, at 4 in the morning, had dinner at 10, took tea at 2:30, and was back in her bed at 5. This regime never varied, either winter or summer, and belonged very likely to her childhood days when she lived in the woods with her father. To me, it seemed like a monstrous arrangement, upsetting the roots of order. But Granny Trill's time was for God, or the birds, and although she had a clock, she kept it simply for the tick, its hands having dropped off years ago. Granny Trill's cottage door was always open, and her living room welcomed us daily. Not that she could have avoided us anyway, for she lay at our nimble mercy. Her cottage was just outside our gate, and there were geraniums in pots round the door. "What are you doing, Gran?" "Just biding still. Just biding and combing me bits." The room was blue and hazy with wood smoke. We prowled slowly round its treasures, opening boxes, filling teapots with cotton reels, skimming plates along the floor. "You going bald, Gran?" "I still got me bits." "It's coming out." "No, it ain't." We didn't think it mattered. It was merely conversation. Any subject at all would do. But suddenly the old lady skipped out of her seat and began to leap up and down on the floor. "Her down under! I got more than her! Her as bald as a tater root! Wicked old lump! I'll see her gone! Her's failing, you mark my words!" When the spasm was over, she was back in the window, winding her hair into a fragile bun. "You 100 yet, Granny?" "Nigh on. Nigh on. Have you got a dad?" "Bless you, no. He died long since. He was killed by a tree over Ashcombe." She often told us the story of this, and now she told us again. Her father had been a woodcutter, strong as a giant. He could lift up a horse and wagon. From the age of 5, when she lost her mother, she lived with him in the woods. They used to sleep in a tent, or a kind of wigwam of pine branches. And while her father was tree-felling, the little girl made baskets and sold them around the village. For 10 years they lived together, and were perfectly contented. She grew up into a beautiful young girl. "Somehow I used to send men breathless." But her father was careful, and when the timbermen came, he used to hide her under piles of sacking. Then one day, she was 15 years old at the time, a tree fell on her father. She heard him shout and ran up the thicket, and found him skewered into the ground with a branch. He was lying face down and couldn't see her. "I'm going, Alice," he'd said. She clawed a hole with her hands and lay down beside him, and held him until he died. It took 24 hours, and she never moved, nor did he speak again. When at last some carters discovered them, she was still lying with the body. She watched them roll the tree off him and straighten his limbs, and then she ran up the scrubs and hid. She hid for a week near some foxholes there, neither ate nor drank. Then the squire sent out some men to look for her, and when they found her, she fought like a savage. But they managed to carry her down to the manor, where she was given a bath and a bed. "That was the first bath I ever had," said Granny. "It took 6 of them to get me soaked." When she finished her story, her chin was resting in her cup, and her features were abstracted and bright. Sharp little veins crackled round her eyes, and her skull pushed hard through the skin. "My dad planted that tree," she said absently, pointing out at the old crack window. The great beech filled at least half the sky and shook shadows all over the house. Its roots clutched the slope like a giant hand, holding the hill in place. I had thought such trees to be as old as the earth. I never dreamed that a man could make them. "He were a young man then, of course," said Granny. "He set it afore he got married." She squinted up at the height of the tree and sat there nodding gently, while a branch of green shadows thrown by its leaves moved softly across her face. "I got a see to summit," she said abruptly, slipping creakily down from her chair. She left us then, gathered up her skirts, and trotted lightly along to the wood. We saw her squatting among the undergrowth, bright-eyed like a small black partridge. Old age might compel her to live in a house, but for comfort, she still went to the woods.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now it's time for the history of the theatre in Bristol in 9 parts. Today, excitingly, part 8. Will the old Vic be sold to build a bacon factory?
A man came to me at a fair and said, "If you've a poet's tongue, tumble up and chant the air that the stars of the morning sung. I'll pay for you if you sing it nice a penny piece." I answered flat, "Sixpence is the proper price for a ballad such as that." The story of Bristol stage from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts. Part 8, Will the old Vic be sold to build a bacon factory? After the First World War, there was a theatrical reaction, with the result that musical comedy and lighter plays of a flimsy and frivolous type often usurped the place of legitimate drama. This state of affairs frightened men who loved art and literature, and in many large towns, repertory companies were formed, modelled on the old stock companies of our forefathers, to produce the best plays for lovers of the stage. The effect of these repertory companies is generally the production of better plays in the old established theatres. In Bristol, the new rep began during the winter months. Both our theatres being engaged with pantomime, the playgoer was left stranded. The Rotary Club, a body of really public-spirited men, decided to slip up to the breach. Their secretary, Mr. Hill, who loves the stage, arranged with the civic authorities to turn the Lesser Colston Hall into a little theatre. This was arranged for the pantomime season, but the public responded so readily that the little temporary theatre seems on the high road to becoming a permanent Bristol playhouse. It certainly was conceived in love and eager passion for art, and it seeks to produce the best plays for us on Colston Street. It's an excellent education for theatre-goers to see the plays of all our leading playwrights, and it has inspired many of us with that unruly passion, the desire to write plays of our own. Civic authorities have encouraged the venture. The Little Theatre has two links with the past that appealed to us. Mr. Harvey, the producer, received his earliest education in the amateur theatricals of Mrs. Robertson Fullis, the sister of Tom Robertson and Mrs. Kendall. Tom Robertson was famous for his plays School and Cast, and Mrs. Kendall is particularly dear to us. The Old Theatre once more. There are some moments in our lives that we wish to blot out of memory. One of those was when we heard a whisper, a rumour, that our beloved playhouse might be sold for a bacon factory. What this might be, we did not stay to consider. Such subtleties of humour were too gross for us then. It was enough that our theatre was threatened, and that it was conceivable that one of the most famous theatres in the world might be degraded to this. Days and weeks of uncertainty followed, and then news. Good news. Our little playhouse was saved. Oh, the breathless joy of it, saved at the last moment, an unexpected reprieve. How grateful we are to the man who saved the old theatre, the old Vic. And not we only, but the English-speaking world, all who value our fine tradition. Incidentally, he's a man of splendid theatrical reputation, and is a fit person to manage this historic house. We, in our distress, would have welcomed him had he brought a circus, but instead, we have indeed been fortunate. Mr. Douglas Miller is a man of frail health, but animated with an intense love of the stage, and what appeals to Bristolians in a peculiar way, his love of the old theatre is as tender and passionate as our own. He loves those walls, and every stick and stone within them, as we do. That was part 8 of The Story of the Bristol Stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. Next week, part 9, The Actors' Church Union. The Avon Association of Drama covers the Bath, North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas and publishes Prompt magazine 10 times a year. Other activities include festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year, and the Avon Association of Drama's website is at www.avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is subscription secretary on 01454 238 384.
Well, thank you to Mr. Douglas Miller for saving the Bristol Old Vic. I think we could probably do this help again right now, I think. Right, it's time for the Cuban Boys.
Most of us just sell out right away.
Hey!
Now time for a man for whom we had to build steel-reinforced walls in order to contain his mighty prowess. With his chiseled jawline, he is known in certain South American tribes as Jeff Le Diabolis.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What Song Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 3rd of October, at the Bunch of Grapes in Denmark Street in Bristol, Madame Arthur will be performing. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. Also on October the 3rd and at Ye Olde Farmhouse in Lansdowne Road in Bath, the swing and jazz group The Mandibles will be performing. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Raven. Now this group were part of the new wave of British heavy metal movement, which started up in the late 1970s. This track is from the Live at the Inferno album, which was released in 1984, and is titled All for One.
Are we all together? Are we all for one? All for one? Come on, let's hear you! All for one!
Raven with All For One from the Alive at the Inferno album. For more information, you can check out www.ravenlunatics.com. They'll be doing the UK tour in October, so check out the dates on the website. Moving on to Saturday, 4th of October, and at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Dukes will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £21 in advance and £25 on the door. Also on 4th of October, and at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol, Flash Harry will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, on Sunday, 5th of October, and at the Carnation Tap in Bristol, James Morton and the Lunatics will be performing. The gig will start at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that was Jeff Sparks with his prow jawline jutting out into the cold, breezy night like the prow of a steel naval dreadnought, his leather trench coat flapping in the breeze. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect Radio is a community internet radio station broadcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and on BCFM 93.2 in the Bristol area. The show is run by the Bristol Radio Co-op, and anyone can contribute. So that's you, sat around, driving along, or walking about. If you'd like to, either in reporting or on the engineering side, do get in touch with us by calling Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Reports this week were Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and Jeff Sparks did the What's On Guide. Studio production this week was by Phyllis Trichkuren and Mark Condon, and the producer was Tony Gosling. That was Dialect Radio, and I'm John Peters Cohen, wishing you a very good week. So until the next week, from the Dialect team in our Queen Square studio on Bristol, thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.